Welcome to Top Shelf at the Merrick Library with your host, Carol Ann Tack.
Welcome to episode 47 of Top Shelf at Merrick Library. I am your host, Carol Ann Tack. Thanks as always for joining me. And I'm going to jump right in here and say that many of you know today's guest, Greer McAllister. She is the author of The Magician's Lie. That was her debut novel, and that was a USA Today bestseller. And it was also an Indie Next pick and a Target Book Club selection. And then she followed that up with Girl in Disguise. And that was one of my favorites because it featured the first female Pinkerton, Kate Warren. And then that was followed by Woman 99, which was a total nail biter. That was inspired by the fearless, fearless journalist, Nellie Bly. And that book, Woman 99, is now headed to the TV screen, produced by the incredible Bruna Papandrea. But this week, I want to talk about Greer McAllister's unbelievable new book, which is just out. It is a heart-stopping book called The Arctic Fury. Greer McAllister, thank you so much for joining me today on Top Shelf at Merrick Library Podcast.
Thanks so much for the invitation. I really appreciate it.
First, congratulations on book launch week. I mean, what a week for you.
Right. Yes, it's out. It's in the world now.
So what has the week, I mean, I know it's brand new, it's just come out, but the week, what has this been like? Because you've been through this before with your other books, the book launch. I'm sure this one is completely different. How has that been for you so far?
It is different in a lot of ways. I'm one of the lucky authors who gets to go on book tour usually. And so I'm used to being away from my family and, you know, strange city and hotels, worrying about whether or not I'm going to make a plane. And so in a lot of ways, it's easier just to be at home and to have my familiar things around me, and then also get to reach out and interact with readers through things like podcasts, through virtual events that I'm doing through bookstores and libraries. I can co-appear with any of my author friends, no matter where they are. And that's been a real silver lining. So that's lovely. I spent most of Tuesday on Instagram, just liking people's posts about my book.
What I love is seeing the authors interviewing each other when they do these book launches. And that's been wonderful for me as a reader, me as a librarian, and me as just a plain old fan. But to the matter at hand, could you please, for those of you who don't know, could you please tell listeners what The Arctic Fury is all about?
Absolutely. The Arctic Fury is a historical novel set in the 1850s, and it's about 13 women who join a secret expedition to the Arctic in search of a lost set of men and ships. And then what happens when not all of those women come back. So it follows two timelines. It's 1853 when they're on this treacherous journey into an extremely hostile environment on a rescue mission. And then the other timeline is a year later when the leader of the expedition is on trial for the kidnapping and murder of one of the other members of the expedition. So you sort of know part of what has gone on, but in those alternating chapters, it sort of reveals some of the good things, some of the bad things that have happened, and who has made it back and who hasn't made it back. And there are 13, I won't say 13 main characters, but there are 13 characters on the expedition, and they all get a chapter to talk about themselves. And I still can't believe my editor let me get away with that. It's kind of ridiculous, but I think it's really the story needed it. And as you hear authors talk about why they made certain decisions, you'll hear that over and over again. The story had to be told that way. And I'm glad that it was.
I am glad as well. I think listeners and readers will be thrilled as well. So kudos to the editor. It's so important for all of these women to have their voice. And as a reader and a fan, I'm very appreciative that that decision was made. The book kicks off with two quotes. The first quote is from Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was an abolitionist and a leader of the women's rights movement in the 1800s, which is shocking in and of itself. The quote is, "We cannot say what the woman might be physically if the girl were allowed all the freedom of the boy." And then the second one is from Louise Arnor Boyd, who is a famous American Arctic explorer. And she says, "The real work of an expedition begins when you return." What I find absolutely amazing is that you've taken these two quotes and set us up for the two different narratives that we are about to read. You have done that
so beautifully. Did you set out to do that?
This is great. Thank you so much. No one has asked me about this, so I'm sort of interrogating myself here. Like, why did I do that? But I think the Louise Arnor Boyd quote came early on before I had even started writing the book, because Louise Arnor Boyd was an amazing polar explorer who came later. So she was not somebody that I could integrate into the book. But that idea of the real work of the expedition beginning when you return, and I knew at that point that there was going to be the trial and that it would be after they returned that a lot of activity and happening and emotion and fear and all of that would still be really, really important. So that's why I pulled that one. And then the other, you know, there are people who say, oh, the 1850s, women were, you know, they were wives and they were mothers and they were in their home. And it was the Victorian ideal that the woman just took care of everyone else and never went anywhere or did anything interesting. And sure, culturally, maybe that was the ideal. But I think we know from living today that not everybody is doing exactly what the quote unquote culture or the quote unquote society says you should do. And thank goodness for that, because we're all so much more interesting when we're doing different things. So the idea of, you know, as far as I know, there never was any all-female expedition in the 1850s. I sort of write at the edge of plausibility, which is why I'm a novelist, not a biographer. And so thinking about the arguments that people would make against something like this happening, I could easily imagine people saying, oh, well, men are so much more physically strong. Women couldn't possibly have handled that. And when I ran across the quote that you mentioned, I felt it just was perfect for the epigraph, because we don't know. And that's what Elizabeth Cady Stanton was saying, is girls were not encouraged to go out and be physical and climb mountains and run and all that at that time. And I think we see now in modern society, female athletes are doing absolutely amazing things. So that idea of you don't know what someone is capable of unless you give them the ability to expand in that direction, I felt like it's, you know, it was appropriate then and it's appropriate today.
And when you discover those quotes, there must have been a eureka moment for you. Like, oh my gosh, that's the one.
Yep. They clicked into place and I didn't have to change them. And that is not always the way with things in books. So it is a great relief. And like you said, just that feeling of that's it. Perfect.
I also admit to being completely obsessed, like many others, with both the ill-fated Franklin expedition. And then we had The Terror, which was AMC, based on the incredible book by Dan Simmons. And then we had Alma Katsu's book, The Hunger, which talks about the Donner Party. And that book just gives me the chills. And then recently, Christina Baker Klein wrote about, she wrote The Exiles, and she actually mentions Lord and Lady Franklin. And then I pick up Arctic Fury, a thriller, mystery, adventure story. What made you choose the Franklin expedition?
Well, I think it is fascinating, of course. So I first ran across the idea of this lost couple of ships in a Margaret Atwood short story in graduate school. And it's part of Canadian history because people were searching for so long for these ships. And she had sort of focused on one of the interesting revelations is that they thought the Franklin expedition might have been killed by lead poisoning, because when the ships came over from Britain all the way to the Arctic, they brought their own food with them. So they had huge quantities of canned food and they had gone with a cheap supplier. And so there was lead leaching from the cans into their food. And that's just chilling. It's like, yeah, it's all you've got, but it's killing you also. So that sort of seized me. And then I read a book a few years later by Andrea Barrett, The Voyage of the Narwhal, which is about a fictional expedition that went in search of the Franklin expedition from America, which several expeditions did. And it's a wonderful book. It's great. And it has strong and interesting female characters, but those strong and interesting female characters are reduced pretty much to waiting for the men to come back, which is historically accurate. But I thought, I always want to write a what if story. I want to say, well, what if women had gone? And Lady Jane Franklin, like you mentioned, who features in Christina's book also, Lady Jane Franklin did consider going on one of these expeditions herself. She was a very bold woman for the time. She had sailed on a barge down the Nile. She had gone to Malta by herself. She had climbed mountains and done a lot of interesting things. So it wasn't that far of a leap for me to say, well, maybe she got tired of sending expeditions full of men who didn't find her husband, and maybe she would try sending women.
Amazing. And as a fan of your work, you're always featuring these just powerful historical women, and you escort them into the front row for readers. It's just very refreshing, and it's enabling. It makes you feel, as a reader, that you can do these things. Now, that doesn't mean I'm about to get on a whaling ship and head up to Repulse Bay, but there are women out there who are absolutely up for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people have asked me who I would be on the expedition, and I said I wouldn't be on the expedition. I am Lady Jane Franklin. Never would have found out about me. Never would have had any interest in me. I have not done anything physically bold like that. So if I did go, I would probably be Margaret, who's the one who's watching everybody else and writing everything down. But that would probably be the limits of my contributions.
And it is a grueling, not for the faint of heart, experience to get on this particular whaling ship, or any, as a woman in that time period, and experience everything that they did. The fact that the setting is so different, right? It's off the beaten track. Truly, it's kind of got this exotic feel. And even when I watch these survivor shows that are all over television now, the Arctic, they're living below zero and off the grid, I would not be able to do that. So when I see what's happening with this new expedition that Lady Franklin sets up, and these 13 women go off, I'm not familiar with the area as a reader. It's so exotic, it makes it a page-turner, because really, it's woman and or man against Mother Nature. What you do for us is you bring us back and forth between a stuffy courtroom in Boston to the frigid tundra of the Arctic. This is really rough. As a writer, when you put yourself there, I mean, did you grab a blanket and cover yourself up as you were typing? How hard is that for you to immerse yourself in that place?
Yeah, I think it's partly my job to make the reader feel cold. So I do want to feel that cold myself. So I did go out and stand outside when it was winter, when I was writing some of this, to do that. And then I was also reading a lot. This has been different from some of my previous books in terms of the availability of research. You know, you mentioned Kate Warren, who, you know, we know a few things that she did, but there are no diaries, there are no letters, there's not even been a really great photograph of her. And so that had to be largely a work of imagination of what life she must have had in order for her to do the things that we know that she did. In the Arctic, this was at the 1840s, especially, is a time of great exploration. And part of the job of the people who were exploring the Arctic was to write down what they saw. So they have very detailed journals and letters and information, reports that they sent back to Hudson's Bay Trading Company, and lots of different material to draw on. So I could pull out what they were talking about, what they had experienced, and imagine myself in that position. And then so much of fiction, I feel like, is the correct choice of detail. And so I don't need to tell the reader exactly what they're going to see, exactly what they should be feeling, exactly everything surrounding them. But if I mention a specific thing, like your fingers starting to go numb, then you can make it a work of your imagination.
Yeah. And that opening, there's one of the opening scenes where Virginia is sitting there looking at the women who make it back, who are sitting there with her, and she describes them physically. It gives a very big clue into the arduous task the expedition was for them. And I don't want to say more than that. So just hold on to your hats, folks. It's pre-Civil War time period. The book explores racism, inequality, sexuality. I think it's so important that you bring that in for the reader, because you make it a part of the story, because it is part of the story. It's not something that you gloss over. It's front and center for us. So I really appreciate that you did that. Did you find a lot of references in your research to these topics?
Not that much. And I think that's part of the overall flattening of history and the version of history that we find in our history books, which is stories that white men with power at some point decided were important to tell. And those are part, the history book history is part of what we should know. But we should also know that all the kinds of people we have now have always existed. So to leave them out of the story is irresponsible. So I always try to write inclusively, and I've made it a real priority in my last several books to make sure that I'm reflecting the time accurately, that I'm bringing people into the story who were not part of the story when I was growing up and reading fiction or nonfiction about history. And it, some people don't react well to it. Some people say, well, you're forcing diversity into this party. And I'm saying, these are the people who were doing these things. Caprice is a rich white lady from Boston, and she's in there. And then she drags along her maid, who is an African-American with a very different life experience. And what is that like for Elizabeth? So I really wanted to have these different stories. And like you said, just all of the different experiences that these women had. And some of them are based on real women of the time, like Dove, who is based on Sarah Bowman, who was a battlefield nurse in the Mexican-American War. And others are just sort of synthesized from sources. You know, Irene, there were men who were trappers and hunters on the frontier, and many of them had wives. And so I'm imagining sort of the experience of a trapping slash exploring wife, even though I didn't have a particular woman in the historical record, because that woman never would have had the chance to write her story down.
My next question was actually going to be, were any of them based on historical figures?
Yep. Dove is based on a real person. Margaret is based on a real person. Christabel, the illustrator, is based on one, because there were a few women who would accompany exploration parties like to South America or whatever as botanical illustrators, who would draw, because that was part of what the exploration was about, was finding new things. And you didn't have a camera to take with you, so you needed to take someone with you who could draw with perfect detail. And so there were a few women doing that kind of work at that time. Those are the main ones. They're in my author's note. So if readers are curious about who is based on a real woman with a documented history, they can find that in the author's note.
Excellent. As you do brilliantly in The Magician's Lie, the Arctic Fury does go back and forth between the two timelines. The book not only becomes this race to find the members of the Franklin expedition, but also a murder mystery. And that's what makes the Arctic Fury so compelling, because you want to know how it happened. You give us this information. Here's Virginia. She's on trial for this murder. Was it murder? How did it happen? And if so, if it was murder, who did it? And that makes it such a page turner. Did you set out to write this mystery?
I would say yes, I absolutely did. I wanted a way to keep that tension up. And as you mentioned, I had done this in The Magician's Lie, going back and forth between a present day that is still in the past and a past that is even farther past. But in The Magician's Lie, what you have is a woman telling her own story. So there was a lot of tension in the scenes where it's just her and Virgil in the police station. But then she's telling a much more epic, broader story about her entire life. And so the tension is, it's a different kind of tension going back and forth. In this one, it's tense in the courtroom because a woman could be put to death. And it's tense on the expedition because anybody could die at any time. And I really wanted to do that. From the very beginning, the whole concept of the book was definitely there's a murder trial, because The Magician's Lie doesn't have a murder trial. Right. It's not too much of a spoiler. It's been, you know, 5 years, but somebody may or may not have killed someone, but it's very different to go through and have people give evidence. And then having that, I won't go too much into detail on that, but historical fiction is never really just about the past. And so there were some sort of things happening in contemporary society that affected how I wrote the courtroom scenes. And I will leave that at that.
So you did this with Magician's Lie. Was it more complicated for you because that narrative was new? Was it harder this time with the Arctic Fury, structure-wise? Do you feel like, oh, I'm revisiting something I really enjoy writing from the style perspective?
It was easier than I thought it was going to be to write this particular one. And I was under a lot of time pressure. The Magician's Lie, because it was my first historical novel and because I didn't know what I was doing, took me 5 years, because I was trying to research and write at the same time. And I would stop writing in order to find a detail. And it was a mess. And I had to do a lot of rewriting. And this time around, I wrote it much faster. Now, I still had to break my cardinal rule and research and write at the same time, which I don't recommend. I really like to do a bunch of research, then write a draft, then find more research to sort of fill in where I know I need to fill in. But this one, there was just so much research and a shorter time to write it. So I was really still devouring those journals as I was putting together the expedition. But it really surprised me that having the 13 different points of view made it easier in a way, because the women had to speak in a certain order to make everything make sense. And so in The Magician's Lie, things moved around a lot more. She could tell a story on page 35, or she could tell that same story on page 250. And some things did move that much. But in this particular case, especially with the geography of it is locked, you start in Boston, you have to go north and north and north and north to get where the search area is for the Franklin Expedition ships. So between the physical route being locked and the schedule being locked, because it takes the time that it takes to do these things, and then knowing that I had to fit in only one time each these other 12 speakers. Virginia speaks a lot more than anybody else, but everybody gets, all of the women on the expedition, I should say, get a chapter to speak their piece. And it has to happen in a certain order because of certain things that cause people to exit the scene. So I'll leave that at that. But it was a very hard book to write, but the structure was not the problem, which is great.
Yeah. And just listening to you say leaving Boston and going north and north and north, can I just tell you my stomach was dropping each time you said, because in my mind, I'm picturing everything they had to do. And even on a good day, when you are leaving civilization as they knew it and kept going further and further away from it, it is very hard and very scary. So listening to you say that filled me with dread, which I guess, hooray, that's the point.
That's my point. Yay.
Yes, good job. When you were writing, did you have Boston written first and then the Arctic scenes, or did you do that chapter by chapter?
I actually write completely out of order. So I outline the whole thing so I know what scenes need to be written, and I make a little list or I put them on post-it notes and I check things off as I finish them. So I might have written, I did write the very beginning first, because this was another one, like all the books since The Magician's Lie have been sold on proposal. So I write a synopsis, I write the opening chapters, and then I say to my publisher, would you like this? And if so, how much money will you give me for it? I mean, my agent does that. But I start it and I know where it's going, but I don't write the whole thing before I enter into a contract that promises that I will write it. So I started at the beginning. I knew where it was going to end up, but then I did just start writing random pieces here and there. So I wrote some scenes on the Doris. I wrote some scenes on the ice. I must have rewritten the scene where Virginia and Caprice meet about 17 times. Like, I had to get that right because the relationship between the two of them is sort of the hinge for everything else. Because if one of them is accused of murdering the other one, you want to know what's going on between the two of them. So I had to rework that a lot. But I'm a very revisey kind of writer. I write very sloppily in the first draft just so that I have a first draft. And then I spend several months going back and fixing all the things that need fixing.
Something you mentioned at the beginning is that you have the 13 women each having a voice. That piece of character development just nails it for the events that occur on the ship, on the Doris. And you kind of then can anticipate, if this is going to happen, how is this person going to react? So the reader gets more information. It informs us in a better way. So I'm really appreciative that you were able to do that. And thanks again to the editor for letting that happen. Still, as I said earlier, you left me gasping for breath. And even though the book clocks in at close to 400 pages, it's like 380 something, I zipped right through it. I mean, I was gone for the weekend. The people were like, where are you? I'm like, I'm in the Arctic and I'm not very comfortable right now. I mean, that's the plain truth. Is there one character that sticks out for you the most?
I think, I mean, Virginia and Caprice both are so important, and I really had to lock their dynamic and their characters down. So I spent the most time on them. But I think I got a soft spot for Doro, who's the navigator, and I have a soft spot for Siobhan, who's the doctor. Both of them, I feel like their stories were super important to tell. And I can't explain why unless you actually read it.
Doro,
so you're going to have to, sorry, everybody, you're going to have to read it.
Right. Now that, I don't want to say now that it's finished, because really you're just kicking it off the ground. But where can readers find you on social media if they want to follow where you're going to be appearing, other than February 6th at the Zoom book discussion at the Merrick Library.
I try to keep everything up to date on my website, which is just careermcallister.com. There's an events page there that'll list, for example, the Merrick Library Book Club and the other events that I have. I don't have a whole lot happening the rest of this month because I think a lot of stores and libraries are saying, let's get through the holiday season and then open things up again. And I have some friends that I'm appearing with joint things and their books come out in January. So my January and February schedule is actually pretty heavy. So again, just GreerMcAllister.com/events is the best place to find that. I am on Instagram and Twitter as The Lady Greer because I don't want everybody to have to learn how to spell McAllister in order to find me. So Instagram and Twitter is The Lady Greer. And then Facebook is Greer McAllister also.
Well, you have a great website.
Oh,
looks,
thanks.
Yeah, it looks really good. It's very user-friendly. There's book discussion questions for readers, for book clubs out there. Please go to GreerMcAllister.com. It's worth your while because there's so much information there for your book clubs. Everybody is home, but you can still have your Zoom book clubs. So as you're going through all of this, are you starting to germinate the next? I mean, I'm still with the Arctic Fury. I don't plan on going anywhere. In fact, I mean, there are certain chapters that I am going to go back and reread. Is there anything that you're doing that you think, like a tickler? Do you have an idea for something that you're working on next?
I have a few things. So yeah, so I'm moving into a more active promotion phase versus writing phase on the Arctic Fury. So that's one thing that is occupying my time and my thoughts. I do have a little bit of a tickle of something I'm researching as far as my next historical novel. But I also have this major pivot that's taking place where I am starting an epic fantasy series, and that's going to be released starting in 2022. So actually, the first book of that is already written, and I'm working on the second book in that series. So it's a really, it sort of came out of nowhere. And I decided that I would just start writing and see what happened. And what happened is I wrote an epic fantasy set in a matriarchal world. So it's going to be really interesting to be promoting that. So that's, if anybody wants to just sort of mentally mark or go on Goodreads and mark The Five Queendoms, is that series. And again, that'll start in 2022. So the whole next year is going to be writing and hunkering down and talking about the Arctic Fury to book clubs and doing a lot of Skype visits and that sort of thing.
So it's really, really not appropriate for a podcast host to become speechless. But at this moment, hearing about an epic fantasy trilogy called The Five Queendoms is just shocking, staggering, and blowing my mind. I am thrilled to hear this. I buy a lot of science fiction and fantasy for the library. And once I get into any fantasy series, I am gone. So I can't believe, I think you just gave me a Christmas present.
Wonderful. It's a book I wanted to read and nobody else had written it. So I just did.
Thank you for doing that. Well, I know you're getting on the big publicity push and you're germinating ideas for the next historical fiction. You've been busy with The Five Queendoms. Not that you have any time, but are you reading anything or did you read anything over 2020 that you would like to share?
Oh, so I do so much reading and I'm sort of a magpie and pulling different things because I read a lot of historical fiction because I need to. And because it's what my friends write also. So I do that and I'm reading fantasy to get myself more familiar with what else is out there. I was a big fantasy reader when I was a kid and sort of fell away from it and then came back. So now I'm reading really cool stuff. I'm reading a lot of romance now too, because some days you just need that. So I just started Alyssa Cole's new book, How to Catch a Queen, on audiobook. And one of my favorite books of the whole year was V.E. Schwab's The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue, which is actually both fantasy and history, and historical fiction. So that's the one that really stuck with me. She doesn't need my help selling books because she's been on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks, but it is so good and so absorbing. And that's what I want in my reading these days. I do so much reading professionally because I'm reviewing books for the Chicago Review of Books and I'm, you know, reading things for blurbs and I'm reading things to keep abreast of the publishing situation as best I can. I just want to be swept away. And that is hard to do. But I did get swept away by The Invisible Life of Addie LaRue.
That was some book. Terrific. Yes, totally immersive. And and another book that clocks in at I don't even know how many pages, and it does not even matter because once you're in it, not unlike the Arctic Fury, you are in it. You're in it for keeps. Addie LaRue is a great recommendation. To quote author Christina McMorris, equal parts courtroom drama and literary thriller, the Arctic Fury bears all the twists and turns of a runaway train, a remarkably unique and mesmerizing tale. And that's what she says about the Arctic Fury. And listeners, I absolutely cannot wait for all of you to read it. And Greer McAllister, I cannot thank you enough for joining me today on Merrick Library's Top Shelf Podcast.
It's been just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much again. Listeners, as always, thank you for joining us today. Remember to follow Top Shelf at Merrick Library on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and wherever you find most podcasts. For the latest and the greatest at the Merrick Library, check out our website, merricklibrary.org. Special thanks to Merrick Library Director Dan Chusmere, Assistant Director Diane Bondi, and the Merrick Library Board of Directors for getting us off the ground and onto the airwaves. And until the next time, remember to keep us on your top shelf.